Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Sending 15,000 troops to their shared border. In a moment, the Uber blogger and University of Michigan professor Juan Cole on the situation in the Middle East and how it's distracting from a critical point in the war in Iraq. But first, in Boston, a city reeling from a soaring homicide rate, a videotaped drug deal is the latest piece of evidence in a disturbing police corruption scandal. So far, three officers have been implicated and accused of drug running, identity theft, running a sex club, and participating in insurance fraud. The tape, made by an undercover FBI agent, shows Officer Carlos Pizarro sipping champagne as he and Officer Robert Polito celebrate a recent drug deal. Listen closely, and you'll hear Roberto Polito agree to move another 500 kilograms of cocaine as well as heroin.
We could do 500 keys of cocaine.
Yeah, that's what I want to see.
Okay. We could do 500 at the same price, but here's another thing I'm going to ask you guys. Could you guys also move some heroin for us?
Yeah, okay.
Suzanne Smalley is one of the Boston Globe reporters who broke this story, in addition to this seemingly incriminating evidence about a drug deal. Suzanne, what else are the officers accused of?
The charges are fairly wide-ranging, though Roberto Polito, the accused mastermind and ringleader, is definitely the officer who had his hands in the most illegal activity. Carlos Pizarro and Nelson Cardesquilo allegedly participated in the guarding of drug shipments, massive quantities of drugs. Polito, on the other hand, was pulling over motorists, allegedly, and stealing their identities and selling them to identity theft rings. In addition, he is accused of importing steroids from Greece and distributing them, as well as using them. He's also accused of taking payments to guard illegal after-hours parties where prostitutes and drug dealers mixed with other convicted felons. It's a really wide-ranging case, and the government appears to have a lot of strong evidence based on what we saw in court yesterday.
Well, how deep into the police department does it go? You mentioned Roberto Polito and, you know, his activities, but he is said to have said that he was kicking money up to his superiors.
Well, there has been no evidence of that yet, other than what Polito said. And I know that there are many people, including in the Boston Police Department, who are wondering whether that was just Polito talking a big game. We haven't yet seen anyone disciplined from the Boston Police Department, and if there were more criminal charges, the feds have said that they would have brought them already.
Well, this all comes at a time of the highest homicide rate in Boston in 10 years, 48 murders this year, 8 more than last year. What's been the impact on morale?
It's been very devastating for all the honest officers out there every day risking their lives, and it is a really dangerous time in Boston right now, and a lot of them are feeling very down. As a matter of fact, the acting police commissioner, Al Goslin, right after the news of this broke, made the rounds with other department brass, and they basically said, you know, hold your head high. All of you are doing great work. Though, as these details continue to leak out in court and elsewhere, every day it does get harder for the officers out there working.
Any national reaction? Any sense that you know, this may have spread to other police departments?
I think that everybody in police circles is watching this and sort of breathing a sigh of relief that it didn't happen in their jurisdiction. I mean, the Boston Police Force is the oldest force in the country. It's a major institution in the city of Boston and a place that a lot of people have always viewed with pride. So this has been devastating not only for the officers still working, but also the people of Boston.
Suzanne Smalley of the Boston Globe. Suzanne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now to the Middle East, where the Israeli military is imposing an indefinite curfew on civilians in southern Lebanon as troops there battle Hezbollah militants. Leaflets warn that anyone found on the road would be considered a terrorist. Humanitarian convoys are being allowed to travel, but aid workers say their work has been extremely difficult because of impassable roads and lack of protection. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the prime minister is criticizing a major U.S. operation launched yesterday to secure Baghdad. Nouri al-Maliki says air and ground attacks in the Shiite Sadr City neighborhood left three people dead and could undermine national reconciliation. With violence in the Middle East continuing to make headlines, we've been hearing from a variety of analysts from across the opinion spectrum. And today, Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan. He writes the influential web blog Informed Comment and has been a prominent critic of Bush administration foreign policy in the Middle East. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You've written in the past that Israel had a right to defend itself. You point out also that both Israel and Hezbollah are killing civilians. But in your Sunday blog, you voice suspicions about what you call Israel's disproportionate response. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, well, disproportionate response is a euphemism. The Israeli military has destroyed the country of Lebanon as a functioning society. I mean, it's destroyed roads, bridges, airports, seaports, fuel depots, apartment buildings, offices, on and on and on, all over the country. People don't realize, perhaps, that the Shiite Muslims who support Hezbollah are mostly down south near the border with Israel. But this has been a very wide-ranging collapse of the entire of the country, the Christian, the Sunni, the Druze regions, along with the Shiite ones.
But, Professor, even you write on one of your blogs that part of the strategy, if you will, for destroying the bridges and the roads would be to cut off the arms shipments from Syria.
Well, yes, that would be one reason to do it. However, the massiveness of it is suspicious. I mean, there are other ways of cutting off the society from Syria. The Israelis have complete control of the air. If the Syrians tried to put a convoy of arms shipments over into Lebanon, those can be seen and destroyed. So it seems to me something bigger is going on here. And I suggested, based on a briefing that a friend of mine heard in Europe, that the Bush administration and the Israelis are fighting this as a proxy war against Iran. They want to reduce Iran's strategic depth, and they see Hezbollah in Lebanon as a cat's paw of Iran. And moreover, it hangs over Israel as a threat, the fact that Hezbollah has these rockets and could do damage to Israel. It prevents a big campaign against Iran as well.
But Professor, we're hearing those rumblings here at think tanks in the Massachusetts area as well, that this is just a sort of dismantling as much as possible to pave the way for war with Iran. Was that what you're thinking? Because you write as well that maybe the U.S., maybe Tony Blair, Condoleezza Rice, are even collaborating with Israel on these plans.
Well, there was a report in the New Statesman that Tony Blair was advised well before the war that it would be fought. And there's also been reports of Israeli generals shopping around this war last summer in Washington. So I think it's been some time in the making. I think it's a war of choice on Israel's part.
Despite the fact that soldiers were kidnapped, you think it would have happened anyway?
Oh, yeah. I think they were looking for a provocation like that.
Well, if in fact you're thinking, and again, it's been percolating elsewhere as well, it is correct that there is a larger strategic goal of laying the grounds for a war with Iran, why now?
Well, first of all, the Bush administration doesn't have very much longer to do anything big. Bush is maybe a lame duck by November, and Congress, if it goes into the hands of the Democrats, may refuse to pay for big military adventures in the Middle East. And then the time is right to go after Iran from the point of view of Washington, because Iraq has been taken out as a consideration. Iran and Syria and Hezbollah are the only three players left in the Middle East that offer any resistance to the American order. And I think they think if they can just destroy Hezbollah and detach Syria from Iran, they will leave it completely isolated and open then to American pressure.
And you write that also a part of the timing is something you're calling the peak oil theory of the U.S.-Israeli war on Lebanon and by proxy on Iran. And I rush to say that this is just something that you're thinking out loud about, putting up a theory to see if it can be knocked down. What's that theory?
Well, the idea is that the U.S. Elites want to avoid a crunch that's obviously coming. There haven't been any big new oil field discoveries for a long time, and there is increasing competition for control of petroleum and gas by the big powers. And as China and India are industrializing and growing rapidly, they're using up more and more energy. And I think there's some danger in the view of some Washington elites that China and India will find a way to lock up Iran as a major source of energy. So if you had your eye on the future and this future, this sort of 21st century great power, great game over energy, Iran is a prize and China and India are rivals. And so if you could conduct a regime change operation in Iran and reorient it towards the United States, then you'd be positioning the U.S. Very nicely for its competition with the coming powers of the century.
Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan, also a prominent blogger. In fact, Joshua Landis, assistant professor of Middle Eastern studies at the University of Oklahoma, says that you, Juan Cole, have become a household word. You've educated a nation. But as you well know, you've got your critics. The Washington Times, for instance, saying you're short on scholarship, long on highly inflammatory rhetoric. And, for instance, this kind of talk that you're batting about on the blog is just completely out there. I know you've heard this criticism. And that, you know, in fact, this is something that, you know, was perhaps an overreaction to the kidnapping of two soldiers and got out of hand because Israel maybe didn't have enough intelligence on the ground. That, in fact, you're giving way too much importance to something that actually wasn't a plan at all.
Well, it just doesn't make sense to me that this is an ordinary border dispute. They have been systematically bombing villages, building after building after building, to clear populations from that region in a way that it seems to me is tantamount to ethnic cleansing. So when you say, in response to the capture of two soldiers, what else could they have done? I mean, why in the world would you have responded in this way? Of course, they could have negotiated. If they had wanted to put pressure on Hezbollah, there were localistic ways of doing that. You didn't have to destroy the whole country.
Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan. He writes the influential and many say controversial weblog Informed Comment. He's one of many analysts we've enlisted in the last several weeks of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. And before we take a break, what are your thoughts? Is there a grand scheme behind the current war between Israel and Hezbollah? Or was it a response by Israel to the kidnapping of its troops that spiraled out of control? Perhaps our email address, letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org. You can also call and leave a message. Any thoughts on the conflict in the Middle East, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please include your full name and town. Well, when we come back, right after the break, Juan Cole on Iraq. And don't forget, later in the program, the music of John Pizzarelli. Much more coming up here and now. University of Michigan. He writes the influential weblog Informed Comment, where he's been a prominent critic of Bush administration foreign policy. And Professor Juan, I want to first just go back to Lebanon for a moment. Israeli airstrikes and Hezbollah rocket attacks are continuing in southern Lebanon as UN diplomats try to finalize some kind of ceasefire agreement. Now, we just heard you be critical of Israel, but you've also written that you're no fan of Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah. You call him sanctimonious, full of delusions of grandeur. 10,000 soldiers, Israeli soldiers, have been fighting him and his followers for 3 weeks now. Can he be defeated?
Well, Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, in aiming rockets at civilian areas, Haifa, Nahariya, and elsewhere, is committing war crimes, and I have called for him to be tried for war crimes, and he's killed dozens of Israeli civilians. this is a mass movement. It's represented often in the Western media as a small terrorist organization. It's not. There are on the order of 1.5 million Lebanese Shiites, and they're poor people, and Hezbollah is a poor people's movement. And most of the Lebanese Shiites now support Hezbollah. Hezbollah runs hospitals, runs services, it runs soup kitchens, takes care of people. It has 12 members in the Lebanese parliament, and it has ministers in the Lebanese government, as part of the Lebanese government. It's a mass movement, it's a political movement, and it has aspects of legitimacy in the Lebanese system. So to think that you can destroy it with a military operation is ludicrous. And Hezbollah has been strengthened politically by the Israeli actions, and it doesn't seem to have been at all destroyed militarily. Every day, hundreds of rockets rain down, most of them admittedly ineffectually, on northern Israel, but on Sunday they scored a strike that killed 12 reservists. So whatever the answer is to Hezbollah, this operation is not it, and it's not going to make things better.
Well, what does it say about what happens now, you know, and how effective the government can be now?
Well, the Lebanese government does not have the internal unity that would allow it to make a strong stand in the country, and it doesn't have the kind of military presence that, and effectiveness that would allow it to take on a group like Hezbollah. Hezbollah has 5,000 to 7,000 trained fighters, many of them battle-hardened in a long war with the Israelis. The Israelis are finding them excellent, perhaps the best Arab troops they've ever fought. So the idea that the Israelis could, by their actions, force the Lebanese government to, quote-unquote, do something about Hezbollah is absurd. That's simply not going to happen. The worst-case scenario is the government collapses, and you get a failed state in Lebanon, rather as you have in Gaza and the West Bank, and more opportunity for terrorism and asymmetrical kinds of operations against Israel in the coming years.
Well, Juan Cole, what's your best-case scenario? Do you see any chance that Hezbollah might be the IRA of the future?
Well, personally, I think that it was possible to make Hezbollah the IRA of the future before all this happened. That is to say, there was a process whereby Hezbollah was integrating into the Lebanese government, the Lebanese system. And so it was the flourishing Lebanon, the return to the old Beirut, the Paris of the Middle East, that held the greatest prospect for a moderation of Hezbollah. So I think the Israelis have ruined it. I think that there was a chance for peace with Syria and Lebanon, and that by this massive war of attrition on the Lebanese people, I think that they have set us up, all of us, for decades of turbulence and terrorism. And I do not think the United States will be held harmless in reaction to what's being done. If the people in the United States think that a country can be destroyed before them and that they will be held harmless from any reaction to that, then they've got another thing coming, and the reaction could well come in Iraq.
Well, Juan Cole, blogger and critic of the Bush administration, what does what's happening in Lebanon have to do with Iraq? Yesterday, the U.S. launched a major security operation in a Shiite section of Baghdad where anti-American Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's militia controls the street. Al-Sadr is part of the current government. He backs the prime minister. The prime minister has now spoken out against the U.S. security crackdown. What do you see here?
I heard indirectly from a U.S. Officer in Baghdad that he said that if this push fails, then the whole game is over with in Iraq.
The push to...
to regain control of Baghdad.
Right. And yet, as you write, we don't seem to be hearing as much about that, perhaps distracted by Lebanon?
Yes, the media are distracted by Lebanon. Otherwise, this would be a front page story. You know, it's kind of America's last stand in Iraq, and it's not even being reported.
Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan, he writes the weblog Informed Comment. Professor Cole, anything you'd like to touch on that we've left out?
Well, the moderating force in Shiite politics in Iraq had been Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who has attempted to prevent sectarian reprisal killings and calm the Shiite community down. He, however, has demanded in a fatwa he released last week an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon, and threatened the United States that any party that stood in the way of an immediate ceasefire would face reprisals itself. I think there's some danger that if the war in Lebanon is not over with pretty soon, that Sistani will bring the Shiites of Iraq out into the streets in massive numbers. I mean, far beyond what Muqtada Sadr can muster. And that the safety of U.S. troops and British troops in Iraq could be deeply endangered. So I think it's a very dangerous game the U.S. is playing in letting this war go on in the Levant when it could have very severe repercussions for our troops in Iraq.
That's blogger and University of Michigan history professor Juan Cole. Remember, send us your thoughts here-now.org. We'd love to hear from you. Well, stay with us because coming up, Oliver Stone's film World Trade Center, that's tomorrow, but coming up today, John Pizzarelli. Stay with us.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
A barrel today on news that British oil giant BP is closing a major Alaskan oil field after finding a corroded pipeline spilling oil there. The Prudhoe Bay field on the north slope of Alaska accounts for 8% of the U.S. oil supply and is the biggest in the country. Well, today, U.S. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman said it could take months to return to normal oil shipments from Alaska, and that while there's enough of a reserve to make up for the loss, this is yet another blow to the already fragile world petroleum market. Environmental researcher and freelance reporter Richard Feinberg is a longtime watcher of Alaska's pipelines. He joins us on the line from his home in Esther, Alaska, outside of Fairbanks, with more on how this happened. Richard, you helped prepare an August 3rd report for the Alaska Wilderness League. This is before BP's announcement. In this report, you're critical of BP's corrosive pipe. So I imagine that this didn't come as a surprise to you.
The leak itself was no surprise. BP's apology and the decision to shut down the nation's largest oil field was a surprise. You don't often do that at 400,000 barrels per day at over $70 per barrel. That's $28 million in gross revenue for the day that you're deferring.
What do you think that reflects, that they did make that decision?
I think it reflects a sensitivity to the fact that they have a serious image problem they have to clean up.
Yeah. Well, BP is acknowledging that the pipeline in question hadn't been tested since 1992 with something called the Smart Pig. We're also hearing about something called the Scraper Pig. What are they?
The pig looks like a small spaceship or a giant bullet. It goes into the pipeline. The Scraper Pig simply cleans off all of the accumulated sludge. Then once the line is clean, you can put the Smart Pig through, and the Smart Pig will measure. In this case, it would be measuring the wall thickness to see whether corrosion has been eating into that wall and deteriorating the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And the obvious problem then is if you had moisture and the line were corroding, you could get a break in the line and leak, and that is what happened in March, creating the largest oil spill in the history of North Slope operations, much smaller than the Exxon Valdez, but over 200,000 gallons, I believe.
Well, so given how important those smart pigs are, that they can detect, you know, and perhaps prevent these huge problems, how often are they supposed to be tested? Again, BP has said we haven't done it since 1992, and that's an issue. How often are they supposed to do it?
In the case of the large spill in March, that line was supposed to be smart-pegged every 5 years for the corrosion inspection by the BP operating procedures, and it had last been pigged in 1998. In 2003, by other means, they had determined there were corrosion issues on that line, and yet they still had not smart pigged it. And then in September 05, they found they had a serious corrosion problem on the line, but still had not smart pigged it as of March 06.
Well, and we see two reports. In one, in USA Today, BP says they didn't need to smart pig because the line, the most recent line that had corrosion, carried clean crude. In another report, BP says they didn't use the smart pig because there was too much sludge in the pipes and the pig wouldn't fit. Either way, we understand that one of the most recent leaks was discovered by a worker who just happened to be driving through the field and smelled oil. What does that say to you?
That was the March spill, and that indicates that the leak detection system, the automatic leak warning device, was not adequate, not working properly.
Richard Feinberg, who is in charge of overseeing the maintenance of these pipelines, making sure they get observed?
These are in-field pipelines, and through the years, the Federal Department of Transportation has taken the position, the regulatory stance is to look at the risks to the environment, to people, and to decide which lines need federal regulation. And since the infield lines were remote and at Prudhoe Bay and industrial area, not a scenic mountain area, let's say, it basically was not required that they look at them. That was their determination. They have now changed that.
Well, and I was going to ask, what about people such as yourself and organizations? Is that part of what you do? I mean, do you act as sort of intrepid watchers, and do you enlist workers to help you do that?
We get reports from workers who have problems that they feel their supervisors are not responding properly to. And clearly many of BP's problems have come to light that way.
Richard Feinberg, an environmental researcher and freelance reporter. And one last question to you, Richard, as you speak to us from Alaska. There's some speculation that the state of Alaska might end up footing the bill for a huge percentage of the repairs to these transit pipes. If a bill on tax incentives passes the legislature this week, that bill would allow BP to recover up to 80% of the cost of the repairs, and they're expected to cost about $100 million. What are people there in Alaska saying about that?
It's a mixed reaction. The industry people would say, let's get on with it. The governor looks at the bottom line for state revenue. We're still recoiling from this disclosure, and it remains to be seen what the public understanding will be. To me, it's a clear example of the chronic discrepancy between promise and practice, because the industry takes too long to identify problems, too long to correct them. And BP deserves credit this time for finally acknowledging the problems, but many people, including people from the industry, are saying, gee, there was corrosion? You mean you had water and metal, and there was corrosion? That was what some of the talk was on talk radio yesterday here. How could they possibly be surprised by corrosion?
Richard Feinberg, an environmental researcher and freelance reporter, speaking to us from his home in Esther, Alaska, outside of Fairbanks. Richard, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this quick news note. As the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina approaches, federal forecasters are now saying that the 2006 Atlantic hurricane season should be slightly less active than originally predicted. Instead of the 8 to 10 hurricanes scientists forecast back in May, officials at the National Hurricane Center now expect anywhere from 7 to 9 hurricanes, and they say 3 to 4 of them could become major. August through October are typically the most active months of hurricane season. So far this year, there have been only 3 tropical storms and no hurricanes. The 2005 hurricane season broke records with 28 named storms, 15 hurricanes, 7 major storms, including Katrina, which was the costliest disaster in U.S. history. And we're reminded of it again this August. Well, still to come, singer John Pizzarelli. He studied at Sinatra's knee. Literally, that's how tall he was. And now he'll sing his tribute to Sinatra. And you'll be listening here and now. Are 51 houses of worship within a 7-square-mile area too much of a good thing? Well, the mayor of Stafford, Texas says yes. Stafford, population 19,000, is in desperate need of revenue. It's the largest city in Texas without a property tax and depends on sales taxes and fees on businesses to pay for police and fire departments. But it's also extremely popular with nonprofits and churches, which are squeezing out taxpaying businesses. So now the town leaders have given lawyers 6 weeks to come up with a way to restrict more church building and save the remaining potentially revenue-producing land without violating any legal rights. Mayor Leonard Scarsella of Stafford, Texas, joins us now with more. Welcome, Mr. Mayor.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, first of all, tell us, how did all of these churches end up in Stafford? Why Stafford?
Well, maybe we are doing like the good book says. We've had a very open policy, and we've been very receptive to people, in contrast to possibly some cities are joining us and in the neighboring area who do not have the significant number of churches that we have. The other thing is that we do have a very small area, the 7 square miles you mentioned, so obviously we do not have an unlimited amount of space, and we watch that land area maybe more carefully than some others do.
Well, help us paint a picture of what it looks like now. I'm looking at a photograph in the Los Angeles Times of a huge Hindu shrine right in your little town. It's beautiful. It looks like one of those huge drip sand castles. Will you just lay out for us some of the houses of worship there are?
Well, we have International Bible Study. We have a St. Thomas Church that is from India that basically has all Indians, but it is connected somewhere with what might be considered the Greek Orthodox version of Catholicism. We don't have your standard, the standard Baptist church, the Methodist church, the Episcopalian church. We don't have one of those. We do not have a Roman Catholic church. We do not have a Jewish synagogue, but we do have just a myriad of these, if you will, startup religious facilities, and many of them start in our city, and then their congregation grows, and then they are looking to expand that congregation, parish, whatever they define as the people who attend.
We understand Chinese Baptists, Filipino Baptists, Spanish-speaking Baptists, Muslims, Buddhists.
Right. Then I think it's important to note that probably 90% of all of the people that attend these religious facilities do not live in Stafford. They come from Houston, they come from Sugar Land, they come from Missouri City, but we have a nice location, and we've had a receptive attitude and hope to continue a receptive attitude within reason, but use a bad pun, but they seem to flock to Stafford.
Well, tough situation, Mr. Mayor. I know you've recently asked some of the new churches why they want to come to Stafford. Of course, some of them cite the tax structure, but some of them told you it's divine inspiration. They say God told them to do it. That must be tough for you to argue with.
We don't, and we don't even try. And we simply say we're glad that God is thinking of us and recognizes us, and we certainly want them to feel comfortable in our city, but we have to take the steps that are required to have the best city that we can have, and we certainly do not feel that religion is an excluded component of our city, and in fact is one of the major components of our city, just how and to the extent that it fits in and will expand is something that we're carefully reviewing.
Even God would understand that you need to pass a collection plate.
Well, I think the most of those religious institutions, from what I understand and what I've seen, that is one of their primary things in passing that collection plate. So they need resources. The city has to have resources, and it's something that we're trying to balance in a way that I hope certainly will meet the requirements of the law, and we would even like to think that the good Lord would think kindly of what we're doing.
Leonard Scarsella, mayor of tiny Stafford, Texas, which has 51 churches in a 7-square-mile area. Mr. Mayor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, and it's been my pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. like that standards bearer. But here in New England, he's also that Foxwoods guy.
Yeah, let's live for the wonder of it all. Meet me at Foxwoods.
Foxwoods.
John Pizzarelli, the voice of the Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. In fact, many people here who saw his very popular commercial over and over would say, hey, that guy can sing. He should be in the business. Well, he is. Thank you. He was born into it. His father is famed guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli, and John has a syndicated radio show, a packed touring schedule. He once opened for Frank Sinatra, and now he has a new CD of songs that were written just for Old Blue Eyes. It's called Dear Mr. Sinatra, and John Pizzarelli joins us in the studio. Welcome.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I saw your face light up when the wonder of it all.
Yes. Well, two words I associate with that commercial are medical plan. It's been very good to me. It's about 7 years now.
Well, you know what? And people got to know you who might not have known you through your jazz.
That's right.
Avenue. And now you have this new CD, Dear Mr. Sinatra, a number of songs written specifically for him. What's your relationship with Frank Sinatra?
Basically, I grew up listening to him in the house because my father was familiar with the arranger, Don Costa.
And did your father play on some of his recordings?
He did play. I think he's on the song Cycles, and he was on a couple of record dates. And he did perform with—he was in the band in Atlantic City once or twice. He subbed for Tony Mottola, who was the regular guitar player.
Sure.
And I opened for him in the early 90s in five cities in Germany and then 12 dates in the United States.
And what a thrill for, am I detecting a little New Jersey in the man across from
Yes,
me?
I'm originally from Saddle River, New Jersey, and I live in Manhattan now.
But for a Jersey boy growing up to listening to Frank Sinatra and then opening for him, what did he think of your music?
Well, you know, it was funny. It was as high, you know, it's like there's only so many acts like Sinatra, and so to have been part of that group of people, you know, there was just, it was a whole different thing, you know. The food was better. You know, the whole hang was better. And he was always in the wings. Certain places we played casinos, he'd be in the wings. There wasn't any intermission. So you'd see Sinatra listening to your show and snapping his fingers and sort of cheering, and you'd go, that's weird. You know, it was really very interesting.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, if you don't mind my asking, how old are you? Because you look very young. So.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah?
I'm 46.
Well, so at that time especially, I mean, your friends are off in rock bands. I mean, how did you, I suppose, through your dad, you veered off into this direction?
Well, I grew up with James Taylor and Billy Joel and Jackson Browne, and I had rock bands in high school in the 70s. And then when I went to college, I would learn those songs. Kenny Rankin was a big influence, Michael Franks. And then when I came home from school around 1980, I heard the Nat King Cole Trio records were re-released on Capitol. And that's when I went, oh my God, that's music that I can, that has all the ingredients of things that I like.
Yeah. And in fact, you've sung also Nat King Cole songs, but this particular CD.
Yeah, there's one called Dear Mr. Cole.
Right, Dear Mr. Cole. And this is sort of perhaps in the footsteps, Dear Mr. Sinatra. Let's listen to a little. Here's John Pizzarelli with the Clayton Hamilton Orchestra singing Witchcraft.
That stirs my conscience bare, it's witchcraft. And I got no defense for it. The heat is too intense for it. What good would common sense for it do?
This song, so deeply associated with Sinatra. Do you approach it and say, okay, what do I do here? Do I evoke Sinatra? Or do I try to make it my own? How do you?
I think you rely on the arrangers to do their job. And that arrangement was written right after Cy Coleman died. And I was doing a big band date in New York City, and I wanted something to salute Cy, and turned out to be that. So one of his most popular songs. And it's basically about the orchestra and the arranger and, you know, doing what we do best.
There are some firsts here. You record a version of Nice and Easy with lyrics never before recorded. How did you find those?
Well, I've been friends with Alan and Marilyn Bergman. Alan Marilyn wrote the lyrics to that song, and he sent me this Nice and Easy, and he said, I've written a new lyric for the bridge in the back half of the song.
So let's start. getting cozy. Oh, the future's looking rosy. Those bells are bound to chime. Cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Every time.
I didn't realize that it hadn't been recorded yet until I made the record, and I called him up and I said, has this ever been recorded? He says, no, you're the first person to record that new lyric. So that was quite a thrill.
The wonder of it all.
That's right. I took a chance and I made it happen.
You perform regularly with your dad and your wife, mm-hmm. Jessica Mulaski. By the way, is it true that you call yourself the Von Trapps on Martinis?
Yes, we've dubbed ourselves that.
Well, the New York Times reviewed one of your shows with your dad at Feinstein's. Stephen Holden wrote that to see the show was to witness a complicated father-son relationship whose differences were translated into and resolved in wonderfully easygoing music. So apparently it gets picked up by the audience.
Well, you know, I make fun of my father ruthlessly during the show. You know, there's times when I'll say, we're going to do Honeysuckle Rose. And I turn him and say, we're going to do Honeysuckle Rose now. Because, you know, he's 80. But he's on top of his game. And he loves it. It's part of the showbiz thing of it. You know, we have so much fun with it. Yeah. And people enjoy it. So yeah. It's
well, I mentioned your radio show hosted by you and your wife from your living room.
From high atop Lexington Avenue, up on the upper fashionable Upper East Side, it's Radio Deluxe.
Lucky you.
It's really fun. And we have guests come in, and much like this, we just say, what do you have to say? And we play records. And
except in this case, it's your living room, and they're your friends, Tony Bennett and Liza Minnelli.
Well, yeah, you know. We've had some really great moments. Margaret Whiting sang when she wasn't supposed to and really moved us all. And we've had Keeley Smith tell us stories about making out with Frank Sinatra and, you know, quite eclectic at times.
Oh, sure. Sounds great. Well, let's play a little. Here you are with your special guest. God, how you ever managed to get him to come on, Bucky Pizzarelli, again, your dad. Here's a little.
I haven't been this terrible in all the shows. All of the shows have gone immediately to the Museum of Television and Radio.
Well,
and
you're
this
a little
one's
reclamped.
Going to this one's going to downbeat.
You're a little reclamped today, talking with your dad.
I am
reminiscing.
We've never had the opportunity to actually do it unless we were in a car, and then we didn't have to look at each other. So we were just played "Cry Me a River," but you got to play with Julie at the Americana here in town,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Is that the only time you played with her, or did you work on?
I did a arid commercial with her. Besides, if you believe it or not, I did.
So, John Pizzarelli, apparently a lot more than a commercial for a gambling place.
Oh, well, yeah, I've been very lucky in the past year.
I'd love to close with one of my favorites on your new CD, Dear Mr. Sinatra, We Small Hours.
Great. And this is actually a chart that Quincy Jones wrote for Frank Sinatra. It was only performed live twice.
John Pizzarelli, the album is Dear Mr. Sinatra. John, thanks so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And, of course, see you at
Foxtrot's.
And our thanks to the folks at Radio Deluxe for their help. John Pizzarelli will be at the Newport Jazz Festival this weekend and on a radio dial near you for more. Go to our website, here-now.org.
Is fast asleep. You lie awake and think about the good. Never ever think of counting sheep.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Heart has learned its lesson. You'd be hers if only she would call. In the wee small hours.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The